Our very special guest is a man who is very special in the golden days of radio and into television and movies, just about every phase of show business. Edgar Bergen, how nice to be here.
Well, thank you, and it's nice to say hello to my radio friends. It's been a long, I guess we have some of the old boys and girls still around from, we started radio in 37 and it went to 57, and that was quite a run.
Boy, that was a long, long time.
Yeah, 20 years of radio. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back before those 20 years of radio to, well, I guess we can start in the Chicago area. Lakeview High School is where you went to school, isn't it?
Yes, and that's where I was born in the Chicago area, too, mm-hmm. So yeah, that's going back a little too far. First words I said was Google blah, blah, blah.
And we have recorded them for posterity now.
I went to Lane Technical High School for a couple of years, then I went to Lakeview High School mm-hmm. to finish up, yes. And then I went out on Chautauqua for the summer and then went to Northwestern. And
what was Chautauqua?
Chautauqua was a tent show, but it was sponsored by the businessmen of smaller towns, and they would come in with a tent, and they would put the tent up. College boys would run the tent in the show there and set up the things, and then a couple of good tent superintendents, and they would have 3-day, 5-day, and 7-day Chautauqua, and they would get all their entertainment in that 1 week. There'd be matinee and night shows, and the talent would change every day, so the people would give over their whole week to it. You'd be a different show in the afternoon and then at night. So it just took every afternoon and night. But fine speakers and inspirational. It was pretty well sponsored and endorsed by the people of the town.
Were you doing your act at that time?
Yes, mm-hmm. I was doing Charlie Ventriloquism and some magic, and it was great training. It was good experience.
Charlie was born in your high school days.
Yeah, my senior year in high school, yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, I had a papier-mâché dummy that had no personality, and he didn't look like the voice sounded like. So I saw an Irish newsboy in front of the high school building, copied his picture in my history book sketch, and took it down to a woodcarver, Theodore Mack, who made ventriloquist dummies part-time and part-time saloon keeper. And that's, and my history teacher, of course, the story is, was Miss Angel. She taught medieval and modern history, and she told me in January or February not to plan on graduating unless I improved a great deal because I wasn't doing passing work. Well, I was booked for Chautauqua, and I was more excited about that than I was about graduating. So down in last of March or April, I got Charlie, and then I went on a student's program in the high school building in Lakeview High School. And our principal there was Mr. Brown, and we had a nickname for him, Square Deal Brown, which he certainly didn't object to. And so I went on a student recital, figuring I would flunk out anyway. And Charlie, he was a student there, and he says, school is rough, they really pour it on, you know. I said, what's giving you trouble? He says, well, I got Miss Angel for medieval and modern history. I said, that's a beautiful name, Angel. He says, don't let it fool you, she grows horns at examination time. And then I said, well, then I suppose you spend some time in Mr. Brown's office. He says, I'm in there so much with Square Deal, I have my own desk, and sometimes we close the door and we just play checkers. I said, well, you should be very flattered that Mr. Brown, Square Deal Brown, would play checkers with you. He says, only one thing wrong, Square Deal cheats. Well, next day I went to history and she says, remain after class. And then came the big surprise. She said, I didn't know you had this talent. The world needs laughter more than it needs another history teacher. If you will try, I'll help you graduate. And that's how I got out of high school, graduated. So they say a man is known by the company he keeps. Well, my closest companion has been a dummy, and it's paid off. You know. Then that fall, I wanted to get into Northwestern, and my chemistry was a little low. So I had to go back and face square Deal Brown. And he said, it's a shame to keep Charlie out of college because you're stupid. So after 2 weeks of tutoring, he raised my grade.
And you were at Northwestern, and then while you were there, were you performing? Were you doing
I would work shows? Saturdays and Sundays at theaters around town. And I played my first vaudeville theater. It was out on the west side. I think it was called the New Mabel or something like that. They would have amateurs on Friday night. And then on Saturday and Sunday, they'd bring in paid acts, professionals. Mm-hmm. And if the amateur was good, if any of the amateurs were good enough, they would be invited to stay over and get $5 a day and work with the pros. Well, I was billed as a magician and a ventriloquist, and after the amateur show, the manager came back. He says, Bergen? I says, yes, sir. He says, if you cut out the magic, you can stay. I says, oh, yes, sir. So I guess I wasn't a great magician.
What kind of magic did you do, though?
Bad. Oh, I did the multiplying billiard balls and organ pipes and produce a fish bowl and drop the fish and break the bowl. And, well, I was appearing in one place at some school on the west side in Chicago, and they'd built up a stage of planks on horses, you know. And I had a little stand, magic stand, loaded down with gimmicks and silks and coins and things. And I stepped up on the stage. There was no bracing in between. And the board sprung, tipped over my magic stand. And I said, well, that's the end of the magic. So you had to go on, and I had to do extra long with Charlie or something.
Well, that couldn't have been all bad, I'll tell you that. What was the very first professional appearance of Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy?
Well, that would have been at that. I think it was the New Mabel Theater.
Oh, that was not an amateur program.
No. And then I played Saturdays and Sundays. Oh, in my early days, I played a theater on North Clark Street there. It wasn't high class then, and now it's so long, maybe it's getting classy now. The near north side, you know. And a little picture theater. And a little Ginsburg, Mr. Ginsburg or whatever, he owned the theater. And I got $6 a day for 2 days there, or one day. So he paid me my $6 for the one day, I think it was Sunday, yes. And he says, you do a good act, Bergen. Here's 25 cents extra for your car fare. And I says, well, thank you. It took care of my car fare. And you know, that was a wonderful thing. It was a very generous, very nice thing to give me 25 cents more just because it was a good act. It's like today some people would rather steal $5 than earn $10, yeah. Honestly.
That's right.
But this was a great, it was a nice nice pat on the back.
You know? You really earned that quarter all your life, though, because it's been a good act. It has. Where did you move from there, out of Northwestern, then still in the Chicago area?
Well, my home, my mother and my brother lived on the north side, up on Arthur Avenue, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And then I went into vaudeville, and then I was all over the country. I went from Northwestern out on Chautauqua again the next summer, right past Chautauqua. They had big offices downtown in Chicago there. And I belonged to the Magic Society there, so I would get on some of the magic there. But then I wrote my act. I went in for an operation for appendicitis when I was a freshman at Northwestern, and while I was lying in the side room getting ready to go in for surgery, you know, I saw all the fussing, and I said, gee, this would make a great idea for a ventriloquist actor operating on Charlie. You know, that's a strange time to be thinking of your act. And I ended up doing the operation, and I played it for 10 years, all over America, Canada, Australia, England, Sweden, and I did a tonsillectomy on Charlie, and I had a nurse, and of course, it played very well.
Did you ever play the Palace in New York?
Yeah, in Chicago too. I played it when it was two a day. Played the Palace Chicago, the old Palace, when it was two a day. Yeah. Oh, and then and then I was in the 30s, 34, 35, 36, 36. Vaudeville was dying out pretty badly then. There was very little of it around. And I was playing some nightclubs. I was the first talking act to do nightclubs and played Chez Paris there. And I enjoyed the real success right in my hometown there better than I ever enjoyed in vaudeville. I guess some of my comedy was a little fast or a little subtle for me, and I was doing better there in the clubs. And I did so well that I headlined for the first time in my life at the Chicago Theater, you know. I'd always been a number two act, you know, a feature act. So I doubled. I played the Chez Paris at late, you know, in the night, and then the Chicago Theater.
At the same time?
Same time, yes. I did, I guess, three shows at Chez Paris and two shows at Chez Paris and three at Chicago.
That must have been quite a grueling thing for you.
I only had one day that was more active than that. That was in New York, and it was New Year's Eve. New Year's Eve, yes. I'm jumping ahead a little bit.
Sorry.
But I went to New York. I was booked on Rudy Vallee's show in 1936 in December, and they said, "Come on for another week, would you?" I said, "Yes." And so that day, 31st of December, I went out to Flatbush Studio, Warner Brothers Studio, and I made a Vitaphone short, a one-reel picture, shot all day, came home, and I was appearing at the Rainbow Room in a nightclub, to doing one show there at 10 o'clock at night, and the Rudy Vallee second show. And there was no time to get any food, and so I didn't drink in those days, but I thought some kind of a drink, like Angel's Kiss with a little cream in it, and a little, that made me drunk. I've gotten a little stronger since then, though I have a little more durability. Anyway, I went up and did my second show on the Rudy Vallee show, and then they asked me, how would I like to round it out and make it 13 weeks, you know. But then I went out and did a midnight show, a New Year's Eve show at a private home on Fifth Avenue. And now, that's an awful big day's work.
Wow, at a private home.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that your very first entrance into radio then with Rudy Vallee?
Yes, that was my first into radio, yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, it was the first time that they accepted me. I'd been turned down by several people. I was turned down by NBC in Chicago. Clarence Menzer was, I'll give him credit for it. he was the manager of the studio there, and I went over and I was playing Chez Paris. I auditioned for him, and he says, "I won't go." He says, "And they won't believe that you're doing the two voices, and it would be confusing." I says, "Amos and Andy are doing different voices, and they accept it." And he says, "Well, that's different, and your comedy isn't right, you know." I says, "They're laughing at it at the Chez Paris." He says, "Well, that's the Chez Paris." So, well, a month or so later on, I was on Rudy Vallee's show, and then I was with him. And I was booked back in Chez Paris in February. So in 2 months, I was back there, and they liked what I was doing so much that they piped me in from the Chicago NBC studio. And I went out of my way to go past his office and say, "Good evening, Mr. Menzer, I'm here." He became vice president of NBC, and he was only one of about three or four that turned me down. They wouldn't stick their neck out to put a ventriloquist on radio. You can't blame them too much either.
Well, what made you think that that a ventriloquist act would work on radio?
Well, the first place, it isn't ventriloquism on radio, really. It's the comedy, it's the material. And I thought I was awfully clever. I was sold on myself, you know. And they laughed at it, and it was a good act. My gosh, it was always went well. So then the big problem was when they said 13 weeks was to write a new act every week. You know, I would work on an act for a month and play it out of town for a month before I'd bring it in vaudeville days into New York. Here you write a new act for 30, 40 million people around the country. It's something we weren't. There were no writers available in the beginning. No writer, if a writer would get 10% of an act or of a play and of a vaudeville act, with the idea of writing it and then throwing away and starting again. So it, all the early comedians were damn good writers, like Benny and Bob Hope and Fred Allen and Ed Wynn and these people, they knew from vaudeville what, you know, how to put things together.
The right kind of training ground provided that.
It was excellent.
You were a fantastic writer. Fantastic writer. And a pretty doggone good ad libber, I think.
Yeah, well, I used to have, with Don Ameche and with Bill Fields, they weren't afraid of it, because we used to live in fear that you might use some four-letter word and your career would be over, because it was live radio. Uh-huh. It was a long time before the agencies would accept an acetate or a recording, you know, because they felt maybe it lost something in recording it. So, well, that has changed, of course, a great deal. Yeah.
Well, from the Rudy Valley show, where did you go?
Well, I was on his show 4 months, and then in May, Standard Brands owned a Valley show. I think it was, I don't know what it was.
Fleischmann's East.
And then they started my own show, our big show out here in California, and that was the Chase and Sanborn show. Mm-hmm. And it started with the pictures you saw in there, Dorothy L'Amour, Ed Nelson, Eddie, Bill Fields, Don Ameche, and myself, and that was a big show and big budget. We had all the big names on, all except Greta Garbo and Norma Shearer, a few of those.
Was that an hour-long program in the beginning?
Yes, it was an hour. Yeah.
Gee, just rolled along ever since, just one thing after another. When you first got started, did you you always played in front of a studio audience?
Yes, we had 350 people there, mm-hmm. something like that.
And there were you and Charlie and the whole cast. Now, when did Mortimer come along?
Well, he was 3 or 4 years after Charlie. Mm-hmm. I was busy answering letters. Is it true that Charlie is a dummy? Someone tried to tell me that you do the talking for both of them and all that. So he says, yes it is. And then when I introduced Mortimer, it was the same thing. We know you do the talking for Charlie, but I refuse to believe you do it for Mortimer too. Who plays the part of Snerd and all that? So that was the thing all over again. But you know, people say, isn't it amazing, you know, a ventriloquist on radio, what a difficult thing. Well, it was so absurd that it was such a talking topic that it was so ridiculous. It was a great plus, you know. It was such a novelty that what kept the audience going, of course, was it's the material week after week. It doesn't make any difference whether I move my lips or not for those 350 people or what the dummy looked like, really. But then, of course, I made pictures. Made about 16 or 18 feature films and 12 one-reelers. And so then they got to know what Charlie and Mortimer looked like. Of course, when Mortimer came along, I start with the voice, and it had to be a stupid face because the voice was stupid. Mm-hmm. But still, he had to be likable. I wouldn't want an ugly face on this character. Mm-hmm. And not too bright, but a nice boy, you know. So I studied phrenology and character analysis with the features of the face, and Mortimer is a combination of weak features. He's he's scientifically stupid.
Did Charlie always look the way he looks today?
No, when I had him in vaudeville, he was a newsboy. But then vaudeville was dying in the 32 or 3, and I was booked to play a nightclub, the Helen Morgan Club in New York. And I was going to come in there with, I'd gotten permission from Esquire, Esky, and I was going to have an Esky dummy made up. And I was writing some, you know, nightclub material, wine women and song, you know, and Esky and I, we would be doing the town and chasing the girls. And then I wrote, could I get a copy, a plastic head or something of Esky, you know? I'm awfully glad I did that, too. And they said, we've changed our mind. We want Esky to be known as a magazine and not as a ventriloquist dummy. That was a stroke of good faith, or I would have been paying royalty from now on to permission to use Esky. So there was nothing for me to do then but to put a top hat and tails on Charlie and a monocle on him, which is ridiculous for a boy. But so then he became a girl chaser, you know, and so we've had had all these romances with Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy L'Amour and all that.
Well, all the glamour girls were, yeah, were on the show. Even Mae West was on the program.
Yeah, yeah, we'll never forget that one. Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Well, we rehearsed our script, and it sounded cute, you know, but Mae was holding back a little bit, not in anything she said, but she, you know, she says, why don't you, you know, come up and see me sometime, you know. Well, when she says it, you know, you're right in the bedroom, you know. So if she says hello, you know there's more to it than small talk. So we had some lines such as, she said to Charlie, why don't you come up and see me sometime? And Charlie said, what do? And she says, oh, I'll let you play around in my woodpile. Well, that's kind of cute, until she said it. And then she says, well, I don't know whether I should or not. I'll have to think it over. And she says, that's all right. She says, I like a man that takes his time. Well, so then we got into all kinds of trouble. The network apologized, Jason Sanborn apologized, and I went and hid for a week. And the net result was our rating went up 2 points. Yeah. So we weren't really too sorry.
Wasn't there a sketch on the show, an Adam and Eve sketch too?
Yes.
Was Charlie involved in that?
No, Don Ameche in it. Uh-huh. And I guess because maybe taking it from the Bible or something that I don't even remember what the sketch was, but I should.
Well, it was an Adam and Eve sketch, that's all, but yeah, because it was Mae West and I guess it was Don Ameche, that just didn't, it was pretty funny, I think,
yeah,
but it just didn't work so well. What about the movies? You said you were in a lot of Vitaphone shorts and some 16 feature films?
Yes, yes. Well, I did...
You did a number of radio movies, I think, with Fibber McGee and Gildersleeve.
I did two pictures with, an RKO with Fibber McGee and Molly, Look Who's Laughing and Here We Go Again. Then I did I Remember Mama with Irene Dunne. That was as I played a Norwegian undertaker. Charlie said he was such a dumb undertaker that they had to get a Swede to play the Norwegian undertaker. And then I did a couple out at Disney, and then we did Charlie McCarthy Detective, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and Sam Goldwyn, Goldwyn Follies, and there were quite a few of them.
While you were on the radio, on the regular series, which was like 20 years, I guess,
yeah,
did you continue to do nightclub appearances?
No, but I would, I couldn't get out of town in those days, because I would do the show Sunday night and take my bows and then have a cup of coffee and relax, and we'd do a post-mortem on the show with the writers. And they said, well, we'll all meet tomorrow at 10 o'clock at the office.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start all over again, and you write for the next week's show, and for your guest, and you write in Ameche, and you write in Ray Noble, and all these people. And then if I was working on a picture, why, I would go to bed, you know, and that's true today, people working on television, where they're doing an hour show, if you see these people that are doing a show like All in the Family and Maude and mm-hmm, and the Waltons, you don't see them at dinner parties around town, not very often.
Yeah.
And it's a heavy schedule. So we did. I was always on the writing team and overseeing that, and then I developed writers as they came along then working on a picture like with W.C. Fields, Can't Cheat an Honest Man, the mm-hmm, circus picture, mm-hmm, we'd go out to the studio and we'd get our makeup on and we'd go out on the set, and Fields would get out there and he'd have a writer and I'd have a writer and a script girl that'd take down shorthand, and then we'd say, well, where did we leave off yesterday, you know? We knew the outline of where we were going,
yeah,
but and then we would develop the comedy sequences. And many days we wouldn't get a take until after lunch, but some days we get three or four takes from 11:30 to 12:15, so then we'd get a few takes, and that was no complaints. And I'm not ashamed of that picture. It's played here in Los Angeles 35 times that I know of, And I remember when it was the late, late movies, and then it was the late movies, and then it went into prime time.
Well, the comedy between W.C. Fields and Charlie and Edgar has always been extremely rare. Yeah. When did you first have such a confrontation between Charlie and Bill Fields?
Well, when I was on the Valley Show, Bill Fields sent me a wire, and he was in the sanitarium at the time, and he complimented me on my timing and on the comedy. And so it was a natural to invite him. He was on the first show. And
on the first Chase and Sanborn show?
Yes, first show, yeah. And he got out of the sanitarium then, and the first routine was clang, clang, clang. You know, the ambulance bell, the agony wagon is coming, you know. And then I said, you were quite sick, weren't you? He says, oh, yes. He says, they took a lot of x-rays, six reels of x-rays, you know. I said, well, what did they find? He says, they found I had a hollow leg. Just great material. And he could write. I had just great respect for him because he could write comedy, he could play what you wrote for him, and he could do pantomime, you know. And so then he enjoyed sneaking toppers and kind of dirtying up the script, which we both enjoyed doing.
Did you often just write for him, or did you always write together?
Well,
when he was on.
We would have a meeting and discuss discuss what the situation would be, that Charlie puts a skunk trap in his garden, you know, as a practical joke, you know, and he trips over it, you know. He not only sprained his ankle, but he fractured his flask. So then we would talk about that, and then he would write some jokes, and we would write jokes and talk. I would have the notes with a shorthand girl, taking shorthand. And we would take those notes, and then with another fellow, we would put the jokes, and then Bill would send his jokes in, and we'd put it all together. And Bill would forget which jokes he wrote and which he didn't write. So sometimes he would got in the habit of, he says, the first joke is not very good, so we'll get rid of that and just go to the others. Well, everything depended on the first joke, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like not doing the straight line. Well, I had a film editor do that. The straight lines didn't get any laughs, so he wanted to cut them out. Anytime we wanted to keep a joke in, and his memory was bad, of course, all we had to do was say, oh, no, Bill, that's one of your own jokes. He says, oh, it is? He says, yeah. And I says, and it sets off the others, you know. I wanted to keep it fair. I wanted to keep him happy, and I wanted to... I didn't want him to play second fiddle to Charlie because that would be an insult. So we went on and off this way we did three pictures and 4 or 5 years he'd come on and off, depending on his health, you know.
He was a regular for a long time, and then he'd come back and forth like that. Did he ever,
take a drink? Yes.
His health problems are legendary.
Yeah. He would bring a thermos bottle of martinis to the broadcast and sip through the broadcast, but never the slightest signs of drinking, you know. He had no use for a guy who couldn't hold his liquor, and there was an elegance about Bill, you know. He had his cane and his derby and his spats, and he kind of felt it a little bit, too. Mm-hmm. And he liked to play with words, you know, big words, he says, you know, he says, if we're separated, you know, in the old circus picture, he says, the sheriff was coming. He says, well, kids, if we get separated, we'll all meet at the Grampian Hills. You know, I said, where did he dig up Grampian Hills? I never, it was a funny word. And then I was over in England, and it's up near Scotland. They have Grampian Hills. And then the Upper and Lower Antilles. He'd always bring that in for some reason, where he was such a success.
Was there ever much real ad-libbing between you and Charlie and fields?
Yes, well, they would get a little nervous when, but we would ad-lib and have fun, and they would always come in and raise two or three fingers or one finger, you know, 1 minute to go, get back to the script and wrap it up, you know. Got it. So, he was, of course, you didn't always have to come up with great jokes. It was just the maneuvering and the inflection and playing around that it worked so well with Mortimer and Charlie and Bill and Michi.
Who was responsible for the great Fields put down lines of Charlie? You know, he says, "I'll whittle you down to a coat hanger."
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Your father must have been a gate leg table.
Yes, Charlie says, "If he was, your father was under it."
That's yeah.
it. And then he feels another line. I don't know who wrote the. Jesus, Charles, if I had a shotgun, I'd make a cribbage board out of you. And he says, "One more remark like that, and I'll slit you in two and use you for chopsticks."
That's some great, great comedy. When did Effie Clinker come along?
She was the last one to come along, and I guess that would have been about... maybe 47, 50 and through
mm-hmm,
there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
why Effie?
Why not? Well, she was really better in personal appearance.
Mm-hmm.
But we had fun with her. She was just a change and something. Now, we never used her too much. Then I have another one that I never use on radio, and I only used her once on television, and I use her mostly in Las Vegas and in club appearances, because she's a life-size one that I dance with, you know.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. And she's very expensive, nearly $4,000, you see.
Wow.
But she has to go to the beauty parlor to have her hair done, and dress has to be pressed, but she's a beautiful, very... real dentures and lovely glass eyes, and I danced with her, and she's so lifelike and so nice that they used to gamble whether it was a girl or whether it was a dummy.
Well, Effie Clinker, though, was a kind of a man-chasing gal, wasn't she?
She was pushing her 60s. She was in her 50s, I guess. She was getting desperate, you know?
What was the name of your dance partner?
Podine Puffington.
Podine Puffington.
I named her Podine after a woman newspaper, a newspaper woman in New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
And when I went on a television show with her, and she wrote me, and she says, "My brother is a lawyer, and I took this matter up with him about you calling that dummy Podine, I said, "Would you handle the case, you know?" And he said he refused to handle it because he wouldn't know which one was the dummy. He wasn't sure which one was the dummy.
Let's talk about television a little bit. What was the first thing that you did in TV? Aside from maybe being a guest on some of the variety shows.
Oh, I guess the first thing I did, yes, was Do You Trust Your Wife?
Uh-huh.
Played that for 2 years, and then we got in sponsor conflict. It was an expensive show shot with 9 cameras, and one of the sponsors couldn't afford to go on with it, and then mm-hmm. the other one couldn't afford it. So unfortunately, it broke at the middle of the season, and... then another sponsor was interested and was says that was it. But then he was offered a bargain on some other show that they had to unload, mm-hmm. so he took that and we were left out in the rain. This the amusing thing about careers today, television especially, is like in pictures you're as good or as bad as your last picture,
mm-hmm.
but if your sponsor, you get juggled to a bad time slot or the sponsor has to, because of business reverses, cuts, discontinues your show, you can very easily become a has-been at no fault of your own. And we felt very sure because we were We were number one on the West Coast for the last 2 or 3 months. West, that's where we had a good time slot. And we were, I don't know where we were, in the first 25 or something in New York. Because we're on 10 to 11. I missed all the kids and the old folks. And speaking of television, the one thing is, I just played the auditorium in Sarasota, Florida, and I went up to see Dorothy L'Amour playing Fallen Angels in St. Petersburg. And it's nice to see people turn out for live things, you know, that they're not always dedicated to the tube. And we had a standing ovation at the auditorium at Sarasota, and lovely people, and it's the most efficient, wonderful operation. They'll run matinees and two shows in the evening of different things, 6 to 7:30, and then another one at 8:30. And some of it is free to the public, you know, and because it's a city-owned auditorium. Very well run and very well supported. And I would like to see every town have a small theater that would seat like around 1,000, 1,200. And the performers, the young folks, have a chance to appear before people and not before equipment and cameras, you know. And we are losing, we use a microphone all the time. We're losing projection, you know. That's a special kind of theater, you know. And I used to play the Lowe's and the Roxy in New York and the Radio City. 2,300 people without microphones. In the early days, we didn't have them, you know. And there was no complaints about people not hearing. Of course, they listen better in those days,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and everybody's talking today. They don't want to hear it.
No, well, they want to hear it louder than what we used to do.
You're really very busy these days. You're as busy as ever, aren't you?
Yes, I avoid tension, though. I don't want to get in too deep on that. Well, I did this Orson Welles salute, the Film Institute, which was a very nice thing. And then I emceed the show Vaudeville, which came out a week ago. Mm-hmm. And I've got an hour special coming up now where I play Grandpa. And I played Grandpa, the first Grandpa, in we call it The Homecoming, which they still play at Christmas time.
That's a great show.
And oh, isn't
you did
it
a
fun?
Beautiful job. Were you offered the the role in the series?
Yes, but I thought I should take it a little easier. Getting up at 6 and working, you know, it's an hour show and you're there most of the time. And I thought I should see what they're doing on the other side of the fence, or the other side of the hill, you know. So I've traveled around. I got a boy that's 13 now. I took him to Europe. The two of us went over and had a great time. We visited Sweden, being half Swedish. He should see little what Sweden is. And then we went to France because he'd studied French for 3 years in grammar school, got to Paris and couldn't even say hello in French. And so then I says, oh, merci beaucoup. He says, gee, Dad, you speak French, don't you? I said, yeah, and I never had it for 2 or 3 years either. I've enjoyed him so much. And Candy has made 3 pictures this last year. We visited her in Spain, shooting there with Sean Connery, a picture called Wind and the Lion, and I think it's going to be a very nice picture.
Mm-hmm. Is Charlie around? I'd like to ask him a couple of questions, if we could.
Charlie?
What do you want, Bergen?
Yeah, would you say hello here?
Yeah.
It's to our friends up in Evanston, Illinois.
Oh, yeah, I remember Evanston, yeah.
Charlie, I have a great deal of things to ask you about. I wonder about the time you decided that Bergen wasn't a good boss and you were looking for a job with Fred Allen.
Oh yeah, I remember that, yeah. Yeah, Fred would have been a better man, really. Better partner.
Yes, I remember that too. Remember, what was it where, you ran an ad?
Yeah, in the Hobo News, yeah. And Fred answered, yeah.
And then Charlie says, what was it? He says,
oh, yes, you haven't been working very much lately, have you, Mr. Allen?
And he says, no. He says he had several successful years on radio, and he saved his money, so he had something to fall back on.
Yeah, and now you've decided to get up off it.
Yeah, and then Fred asked me if I work with you Would I get any jokes, maybe just a little titter? And Charlie says, well, maybe a little snicker now and then, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
And then he says, oh, thank you, Charlie. He says, let me kiss the hem of your tuxedo.
It's a tailcoat, Mr. Allen.
Oh. He says, well, I'll blow you a kiss. Oh. Then he says, Charlie, if I put a plunger on your, put a rubber beret on your hat, I could use you for a plunger. He says, if I could put a ring in your nose and use you for a hitching post. And Charlie says, if I put a ring in your nose, you couldn't talk at all. You know, he was had a nasal quality. he was a great joy to work with.
Charlie, did you like working in the movies?
Yeah. We worked, we had a lot of pretty girls.
Yes, in two or three of the Archeo pictures, a lot, Girl Scouts.
Yeah, they, and good Scouts too, Bergen. Good girls.
People who go to the movies would be able to see Charlie dance, and even Mortimer, I think, was running around a little bit in some of those.
Yes.
How was it? Here We Go Again, I think.
Yeah, Here We Go Again, yeah. Yes. Yes.
Yes, I have understudies. Well, this play the smaller scenes, you know.
Well, as a matter of fact, we have a number two, Charlie, where in one picture he had to slide down a banister, you know, and there was some danger of him falling off. So we used the stand-in, you know, Charlie, number two, Charlie, for that. When I went to Vietnam, we did 23 shows there. I had to go, but I took a number two, Charlie.
Well, Charlie, what about Edgar Bergen's always playing the love interest? On many of those movies, you, Edgar, were the romantic lead, as a matter of fact.
Well, thank goodness there hasn't been too much of that lately. He was never very good at it, actually. He did a lot of deep breathing.
Yes. Yeah, well, I was the bashful lover most of the time.
You know, one of the best things on the show that you two did was to when you would tell Charlie a story, and you never got on the point. There's some pretty good stories.
Yes, one we did with Candy when she was 6 years old was a Christmas show, and it took alternate lines. It was a night before Christmas. And all through the house, and Charlie says, nothing was stirring, not even a mouse, yeah. And then the stockings were hung by the chimney with care. All right, Charlie.
Oh, yes, and the lady in the room could stand some fresh air.
And then,
on Donder, on Blixen. And what do you know, Dixon came in and paid $2.20 to show.
I wonder if we can, Charlie, you think we can find Mortimer someplace here?
You're just wasting your time. If you want something stupid, he can deliver it. Well, Mark.
Well, you're Charlie.
Come on here, make a fool of yourself. You specialize in it.
Here, come up here and say hello. Oh, hello. Oh, that looks like a microphone. Yeah. I'm broadcasting, huh?
Yeah, you're on radio again, Mortimer.
Well, I'll be darned.
Yes, yes. Well, Aren't you going to say something? Oh, I said hello. Well, aren't you going to say hello to me?
Yeah, hello there, mister.
Well, you know who I am, Shirley.
Oh, yeah, hello, Shirley. No, Bergen. Oh, yeah, Shirley Bergen.
No. Edgar Bergen.
Well, make up your mind.
Well, you know, I don't have to tell you that Mortimer is pretty stupid.
Yeah, but I've made a success of it.
Yes, you have. Yes, he's done that, and it's helped me too, as well.
Well, it's really been great to be here with the three of you today, we're glad that you spent some time chatting about your careers, and we're grateful for all of the time you spend entertaining us and so many millions of people all around the world.
Yeah. Well, we've covered the world pretty thoroughly, Australia, and four or five countries in Europe now, and Canada, Mexico, and it's been a very happy life. I tell you, if I had my life to live over again, I would like to do the same thing. Of course, I asked Charlie that. He says, if I had my life to live over again, I'd like to make the same mistakes, only start sooner this time. Well, it is, you know, I had dreams of being a doctor when I started out in college, but I dreamed too much and studied too little. And so it's hard to say how many people are alive today because I'm not a doctor. But I have no regrets, and that's it's nice to say. I believe if I had it to do all over again, I would never try to stop going to school. I think a growing, mm-hmm. the studying thing should be, we should never finish with that. But sometimes we allow ourselves to get booked up so much with work or social obligations that that it can interfere with the growing end of it, you know. And theater is not as exciting for young people today because we don't have the theaters and we don't have the clubs. And the television business has become very big business, and there is not much chance to, like, going your own way. And I had scholarship students at School of Speech mm-hmm. there, and I had a nursing fund, a lot of nurses. They are in demand, but I felt very guilty about scholarships in the theater when there isn't enough theater, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Uncle Sam came along and on the nursing end of it and duplicated that and offered more money. I loaned the money, but Uncle Sam loaned the money too, but put him through college and nursing at the same time. And they would be indebted to $6,000, but with the regular nursing, it used to be $600-$700. But anyway, it was all very successful and very worthwhile.
It certainly was. Thank you, Edgar Bergen.
Thank you.